What issue in the news do you want to talk about? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's nice to have you with us on this Friday, March 22nd. This is the Week in Review, when we cover the top state, national, and international news of the week with two guests from different political perspectives. And we welcome your input at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us on Twitter at Joy Cardine Show. We will talk about President Obama making his first trip to Israel. We'll talk about Governor Walker's proposed budget going before committee. We'll talk about gun control and gun control measures. The U.S. Senate shelves a ban on assault weapons and a proposal to require a federal background check for all Wisconsin gun sales is unveiled at the state capitol. Let me welcome our guests. We have with us Steve Prestigard, journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, or maybe that should be good morning.
Are your teeth chattering?
Supposedly warmer, but it doesn't really feel that way.
Yeah, this is our almost spring edition of the Week in Review. Also with us is Christine Bremer-Moogley, attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau and one of Wisconsin's presidential electors. Good morning, Christine.
Hi, Joy and Steve. It's freezing in Wausau. I'm looking at a 4-foot snowdrift in my front yard, but, you know, spring.
Oh, I know. So we're all dealing with that. That should be probably the top issue of the day. We did a Wisconsin Public Radio St. Norbert College poll that we released the results this week, and we asked people what is the most important problem facing Wisconsin, and a couple of people said the weather.
True.
Yeah, it's it really is. Well, anyway, let's warm things up with a little heated debate, so to speak. I wanted to start, I think, with this proposal that was unveiled at the state capitol yesterday that would require a federal background check for all Wisconsin gun sales. This is a question that we also asked in our survey with St. Norbert College. We had 89% of our poll respondents in favor of universal background checks. Well, Christine, are you in favor of this?
Absolutely. I'm one of the 89%. You know, this would include private sales and gun shows. And I just think this is the most common sense approach right now. I think the poll and the national polls also show that even for assault weapons ban, 64% of the people are in favor of an assault weapons ban. And so I think that universal background checks are just crucial, and everyone agrees with that. So it's very hard to understand, you know, why the Congress is balking at this at all. But, you know, if we even went a little bit further, we'd know that, you know, if there had not been an assault weapon, those 26 little children in Connecticut wouldn't have all been killed. The guy couldn't have done it without an assault weapon. So I think it's great that we're doing universal background checks. I hope it passes. I can't imagine it won't. But I really believe it should go further, and I hope that there's some real courage in the Congress to make this go ahead.
All right. Well, first on the universal background checks, Steve, any problem with that?
Sure. Yes, I do have a problem with that. I'm certainly happy that constitutional rights aren't being decided by opinion polls these days. I would like to see the results of a poll of asking people how many people realize the number of federal and state firearms laws that already exist and are generally not enforced. Every one of these mass shooting incidents, it's been proven that a large number, 10, 20 federal and state laws have been violated, and, oh, gee, nobody happens to notice that the laws that we have right now aren't even being enforced. So to pass a law that says, well, we need to have universal background checks, since the government hasn't exactly shown interest in enforcing the firearms laws that we have, I'm unclear as to why we ought to introduce new firearms laws so they can not bother to enforce those either. And, of course, the other half of it is simply the fact that a universal background check is, in fact, a backdoor effort for gun registration, which is the sort of thing that is contrary to the spirit of not just the federal Second Amendment, but more importantly, the state constitution, which is even more clear about the people's right to own firearms for legal purposes.
What about that, Christine?
Well, I think, you know, Steve gives the argument that that the old argument that we shouldn't pass a law because it might not be enforced, and I just think that's ridiculous. I think Senator Feinstein has really shown some good studies that have shown in the 1994 ban on assault weapons that the National Police Federation has shown reports that said crime went down 6.7%. You know, and this ban on assault weapons, it still leaves over 2,200 different kinds of guns that you can have, rifles and shotguns. You know, people just don't need to have them, and there are times when we live in society that we have to recognize that, you know, there is not a need for this kind of weapon when we know that our children and the people in our country are being slaughtered. I mean, how many more days do we have to listen to gun violence crimes and we don't do anything about it? We need to stand together as a country and say it's time that we stop this. You know, in the meantime, we've got record profits coming in from the gun industry because of this talk about taking away weapons. So the NRA is sitting there in control. They are pushing this against Congress because of their big checkbook, and we've got the gun industry raking in profits. So, you know, we really have to say what's going on here, and we have to say as a country, enough is enough. You know, if these children died in vain, and we don't take the initiative from their deaths to say it's enough, then there is something wrong with our country. And I think that people are standing up now, and when we see these huge numbers in the polls. You know, polls are important. We have a representative democracy. So, Steve, I think it's important that it's the representatives listen to us.
Well, let's talk a little bit more. I'll get Steve to respond to the assault weapons ban. The assault weapons ban will not be a part of the gun control package that the U.S. Senate will roll out next month. Majority Leader Harry Reid says he wants to make sure that it can overcome any Republican opposition. Senator Feinstein, who was pushing hard for the ban, says she's disappointed. Vice President Joe Biden says assault weapons could still be banned at some point. He's not giving up. What do you think is going to happen here, Steve?
Well, if you get a coherent statement from Joe Biden about guns, let me know. Because remember, he's the guy that says that a perfectly acceptable way to protect yourself is to fire a shotgun out of your front door. I don't consider him to be a credible source as far as gun safety or that sort of thing. As far as Harry Reid, he obviously can count. And the estimation I saw yesterday or the day before was he didn't think he had even 40 votes for an assault weapon ban. And, of course, that brings to mind the question of what exactly is an assault weapon? And I noticed that it's a definition that really very few people who don't know things about guns, which would probably include most of the people supporting an assault weapons ban, they can't even define what an assault weapon is. And given the fact that the differences between an assault weapon and guns that wouldn't even be covered in the ban are basically cosmetic, again, he can act, or he can add, he can see that he doesn't have support in his own Senate for an assault weapons ban. And even if he did, you know it's going to end up dying in the House of Representatives. I'm opposed to legislation not only that isn't being followed by the federal government, but I'm opposed to legislation that isn't going to work.
Christine.
Well, I think that, first of all, I really, Steve, take offense when you pick on our vice president like that. I think he's fantastic. And I really think that he is so sincere when it comes to this issue and he has put his name on this, and he's not giving up. You know, on the issue of the assault weapons ban, a very quick check on the Internet will tell you that what they want to ban are weapons, assault weapons that have detachable magazines and have at least one military feature, like a pistol grip, a forward grip, telescoping grip. You know, these weapons can be defined very easily. And the question is, and you know, and I represent all kinds of people who are hunters, and almost everyone I know is a hunter up north. And you know, they are in favor of this ban, most of these people. They say we don't need those guns. They want to use their guns to hunt in Wisconsin. And so, you know, who are we really talking about that this is going to affect? And so I just think that if the argument is we don't know what an assault weapon is, that's something that, you know, you can easily check. Secondly, that most people don't believe they even need them. And so I think this is just something that's coming. and people are going to come around to it. Harry Reid, you know, this is going to come back. He didn't have the votes at first, and the idea is let's get what we can get. And we can get, you know, something is better than nothing. So we can get now universal background checks. Let's get it. And they're going to bring this back, and there will be an amendment, and let's see if there's courage and they vote on it.
I got to disagree on one. You say something is better than nothing. That is absurd. There is not. I think one thing that this whole thing demonstrates is the fact that the momentum for gun control after the Newtown shooting is fading out. It's fading out fast. We would have been farther along on this if it wasn't for the fact that people are starting to realize that not a single thing that has been brought up as legislation since Newtown would have prevented Newtown. And by the way, if you knew the number of guns that the shooter in Newtown had, you would know that the assault rifle wasn't necessary at all, because he had several pistols with him also, which had a similar ability to do what he did. So, again, I'm opposed to legislation that infringes on constitutional rights. And the Second Amendment's not about hunting. It's about personal protection. And I'm, again, opposed to legislation that isn't going to work. And that describes this assault weapons ban.
Well, what about the universal background checks, though, Steve? That's probably going to happen, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is going to happen, absolutely. And when I say, if I could just jump in, Joy, I think when we talk about something's better than nothing, I mean, this is about being pragmatic in government. You know, it is important that we have universal background checks. The people of this country want them. And so the Congress has to respond to that. If everyone, at least we can know who are the people that are dangerous and shouldn't have guns, people with mental problems, people like that have difficulties in coping in society and have problems that are easily recognizable and documented, should not have guns of this nature. And, you know, Steve, when we talk about this man that caused this horrible, horrible tragedy in Connecticut, the fact is, if he didn't have the ability to have very fast shooting and shoot so quickly and kill all those children with high-capacity magazine clips, this wouldn't have happened. So, you know, these children were trying, some of them were trying to run out of the room, and he was reloading. And, you know, those that didn't get out of the room are the ones that got killed. So how much more do we have to say, well, this is about my Second Amendment rights? That's just not right. The Second Amendment wasn't meant to protect people like this. Right. And so we really need to look at this and say, as a country, we've had enough.
The last word on this from Steve, and then we need to move on to other issues.
I guess I'd be interested in hearing, I mean, you're saying the Second Amendment isn't intended to keep guns in the hands of people who shouldn't have them. But universal background checks don't work because the system that we have now doesn't work, and the gun control laws we have now don't work either. Let's see something that actually works. And no one has come up with anything that actually does anything except intrude the federal government, and in some cases states' governments, on the constitutional rights of gun owners who are not harming other people with their guns.
Steve Prestigard is a blogger at steveprestigard.com. Christine Bremer Moogley is an attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau. Our two guests today for the Week in Review. We'll move on to some other issues. We'll talk about President Obama's first trip to Israel coming up. We'll also talk about Governor Walker's proposed budget going before committee, and whatever else you want to talk about. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you will join in as John Munson talks about the news of the week as well during Your Views on the News, coming up after 4 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking with two guests from different perspectives about the news of the week in our Week in Review. And let's look at some international issues. President Obama will have lunch today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu before leaving for Jordan as a part of his Middle Eastern tour. While in Israel this week, the president says that Israel has no greater friend than the U.S. He also said that the Palestinians deserve their own state. Christine, first, How significant was this trip by President Obama?
Well, I thought it was fantastic. I mean, I watched the speech he gave last night to the Israeli students and others, and his speech was so inspiring, and it was so open in terms of what he was trying to say. The message was you know, really important, you know, to speak to the Israelis of all people and say to them, you know, all people deserve to be free in a land of their own, and meaning that they should think through the eyes of the Palestinians. I mean, it was an amazing, courageous thing to do. And the fact that was even more outstanding was the applause he got for it. You know, he was telling these students, sort of going beyond Netanyahu and going to the youth of the country and saying, look ahead, look to your future, look for peace, and try to think how you would feel if you were born in Palestine. And the fact that these young people stood and cheered him for that was really hopeful. And so I think this is a very important message. You know, the peace plans have not worked. I mean, he tried in his first term to do something in terms of get a peace initiative going, and it didn't work. So now it seems like we're doing something different, talking to the people directly, which no president really has done. And I'm hopeful that his vision of peace can be shared with the people of Israel, and we really can start looking toward meaningful discussions about, you know, what's going to happen with the settlements, and are we going to be able to not put terms on peace agreements and peace negotiations, rather, and really start get to the table and see if something can be done. So I'm hopeful.
Steve?
Well, I'm incredibly cynical about Middle East peace agreements, not merely because of what Christine said, that they haven't worked. They haven't worked in, what, 2,000 years or so? There's some conflict in the Middle East between one religious side and another, or one nation and another. And so I don't get particularly excited about this at all. I think the difference that nobody seems to be paying real attention to is that there is a side that's trying to protect itself, and there is an opposite side that is trying to destroy the first side. I'd be all for a Middle East peace settlement when the opposite side of Israel says, in binding real-world important language, that we're not going to try to destroy you. We're not going to try to wipe you out anymore. And to say that that's going to happen, I guess, would be a triumph of hope over experience. And the thing, you know, it's very easy to speak to college students. College students are, you know, kind of idealistic. And then comes the real world, and that's what Netanyahu's representing, is the real world. And the fact that Israel is surrounded by people who want to eliminate it off the face of the earth. And until you accept that reality, and until the other countries in the Middle East, Egypt and the others, are willing to say, yeah, Israel, you deserve to be there.
We'll
figure out the border thing. Until that happens, then there is no reason to be very optimistic about peace in the Middle East.
President Obama also said the U.S. will do what is necessary to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Iran maintains it's developing its nuclear program for peaceful purposes. Steve Prestigard, your thoughts on the president saying that the U.S. will do whatever is necessary to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon?
I think it is more likely that Israel will do what is necessary for Iran to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. I don't see anything that indicates that the Iranians believe that the U.S. is very serious about this. And yeah, there are sanctions. Yeah, there's tough talk. There isn't anything that has stopped Iran from getting to the point where now President Obama says they're going to have weaponized, they're going to go nuclear in a year. And that shouldn't make anybody feel particularly comfortable about the situation over there.
Christine.
Yeah, I agree with Steve. It doesn't make anyone feel comfortable. When I hear the president say, you know, we'll do what's necessary, you know, I have visions of another war coming up, and it's frightening. And I'm praying that that doesn't happen. But I agree with Steve. This is not something that is very hopeful right now. You know, are they just using their nuclear research for peaceful purposes? C- clearly probably not. So what's going to happen here? I hope that we can discourage them as the world communities put pressure on them, and that's about the best we can do. You know, we're just coming out of spending $1 trillion in the Middle East on wars. Do we need to start this again? And it's just a frightening thought.
You know, this week marked the 10-year anniversary of the Iraq War. President Obama thanked the troops this week for their service, especially for the nearly 4,500 Americans who've died in Iraq. President Obama opposed the war and pledged to end it. The last U.S. troops left in 2011. So looking back, Christine, was the war in Iraq a success?
Well, you know, no, I absolutely think it wasn't a success. Yesterday I was listening to public radio, and I was listening to one of the veterans from the war say he was one of the first ones in, sort of they called his troops the tip of the spear, and he said, you know, one of the first things they had to do was cut down all the trees in Baghdad, because the terrorists were putting, you know, bombs in them, and they had to tear down all the trees in Baghdad. Just think of a four million person population city with all the trees cut down. And then after that, everything went, you know, totally into chaos. So, you know, it hasn't been a good way for these people. That, you know, you can understand why they're not happy with the United States. And now we're pulling out, and it isn't such a good situation over there. There's still a lot of violence. The agreement to pull out was negotiated, of course, and mandated by the Bush administration, but, you know, certainly Obama supported it, and that's what he won his election on. You know, but we wind up in this horrible situation in our country with our economic problems being so severe that, you know, we can only at this point really look now to our country and say we have to do everything we can to save our own economy. So is it good that we were there? No, absolutely a failure. So I'm hopeful that there can be peace there, but we can't look back on this as a shining bit of in our history and say, boy, that was a good move.
Steve?
Well, put it this way. Ask yourself this question. Would your Iraqis have been better with Saddam Hussein still in power, which would certainly be the case if it wasn't for what happened? Did it run well? Well, generally speaking, wars never end up running as well as they're planned on. I think it's either George Pan or Dwight Eisenhower said if battle plans get thrown out the window after the first shot. The aftermath doesn't seem to have been handled well either, but again, you really believe that somebody has, put it this way, remember the whole weapons of mass destruction thing, which apparently, you know, Republicans, Democrats, Tony Blair and everybody else was wrong about it. You know why they were wrong about it? Because according to intelligence, Saddam Hussein believed he had weapons of mass destruction. Again, it comes back to, you don't want to do something like that, obviously, but the fact is, would you really want Saddam Hussein still in power, still killing his own people, still attempting to grow his own country by running into, you know, all of his neighbors in the Middle East? Would you really want Saddam Hussein still in power in the Middle East?
Well, let's let listeners think about that. As we remind them, this is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Steve Prestigard and Christine Bremer Moogley about the top news stories of the week. We'll move on to some other issues now. We'll let Jean in Madison bring up the next topic.
Yes. Given rule of law and Eric Holder's comments about banks and bankers too big to jail, please comment on Cyprus. And could it happen in America?
Well, could that happen in America? Steve, why don't you start that?
I believe what she's saying is, could the federal government's tax savings, which I believe is what they're, am I right about that? That's what they're doing in Cyprus?
Well, they were because of financial problems, the government was attempting to remove money from private citizens' bank accounts to help pay for that?
Well, with the current makeup in Congress, that's absolutely not possible. In a future makeup of Congress, that's hard to say. It depends on who's there. I can't, you know, there's been suggestions already and I don't know how credible they are, but that, you know, certain people in the Obama administration are looking to get their hands on 401k accounts and other private retirement accounts. I think at this point, I mean, the political blowback from something like that would be enormous, and therefore I think that makes it unlikely, but probably not impossible.
Christine.
Well, it's a great question from Gene. When you think about what happened when our economic meltdown occurred and how it seemed like the people that were calling the shots were the people that were alumni from Goldman Sachs and from the big Wall Street banks, and you think about how little power we, the middle class, and the people really have, you know, you wonder, could something like that happen in our country where the banks really just, you know, take over, and it's a frightening thought. You know, when you think about Cyprus, however, most of their monies, it seems like a lot of their money, according to the reports, were money from foreign investors. So, you know, the Russians are having a fit about it. You know, everybody's having a big fit about it, and it's causing them to back off some of their more draconian measures. But, boy, the question is, you know, how much power do these banks really have? You know, that's an open question. From my side of things, I just thank God we've got people like Elizabeth Warren now in the Senate who is really not afraid to stand up to the banks and really will shine a light on what they've done and hopefully get us more laws that protect the people in our country from banks overreaching. So, good question, Gene. I think we have to keep our eyes open.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you would like to contribute to this edition of The Week in Review. Is there something in the news this week that you want to talk about? The U.S. Senate has soundly rejected a balanced budget plan authored by House Budget Committee Chair Paul Ryan. Five Republicans joined every Democrat present to kill the measure, which failed on a 40-59 vote. Christine, your reaction to that?
Well, that's really no surprise. You know, the Ryan budget is really based on a fantasy. I guess his fantasy is that he's going to be the speaker someday. He's given up on, he's given up on trying to run for president again. But, you know, he wants to impose austerity, put in massive cuts in spending in really much-needed programs in our country, and then come forward and say there's no harm. But let's keep to these programs that the people depend upon, you know, saying that charities should run programs for people and give them, you know, food and shelter and the things that they need when the government decides they're not going to do it. So we give billionaires tax cuts. We lie and say we're going to keep Social Security just the way it is when actually anyone that's under 56 is going to get vouchers. And we're going to increase military spending. So, you know, who would support this budget except people that are politically driven and know there's no way it will go forward and just want to make a statement about what we can do? There's no economists say that it's necessary to balance our budget in 10 years. Even the Republicans don't say that. So, you know, Paul Ryan's plan was very well vetted, I think he forgot, in the last election, and 5 million voters voted against him. So he brings it back again. He says, we're not going to give up. Well, he should give up because this isn't going anywhere, and I'm thankful for that. So he can keep pushing this, but he's going to go nowhere with it, and it's not doing anything to help our country. So I'm glad for the Senate's action, and I'm looking forward to some real action on what, you know, this sequester and trying to get our budget back in order so we can reinstate some of these programs that are so necessary to the people here.
So, Steve, do you support Paul Ryan's budget?
Not entirely, but it beats what the Senate Democrats have brought up, which is nothing. It beats what the Obama administration has brought up, which is nothing. Obviously, the political realities are it wasn't going to pass. But, you know, I don't see anything coming from the White House that is remotely balanced. I don't see anything from the Senate Democrats that is remotely balanced. I got to say, though, that it appears as though nobody particularly is interested in a balanced budget, given who we keep sending to Washington. The fact that you have one party controlling the Senate and the other party controlling the House, and clearly they have different views of government and whether, you know, responsible government finance is necessary. So it's not surprising it didn't pass the Senate. It wasn't going to because, you know, similar to the assault weapons ban, Republicans in the Senate can add two. But to say that, you know, to say that the entire country will fall into chaos if we don't have X percent spending on Medicaid or Social Security or whatever is kind of an insult to people who, you know, who work hard, who want to see their tax dollars go to something useful, which is, generally speaking, not happening now.
Tim and Ladysmith, you can right after we hear from Tim and Ladysmith. Hi, Tim.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I'd like to propose that we have been, since the Obama administration took office, there has not been a budget, which I'm not entirely sure how they can get away with not having a budget. I'm not sure why the Ryan budget became such a big issue. The fact of the matter is, if we don't begin to cut entitlement spending in America, we're going bankrupt. We're $122 trillion or more in entitlement debt for the future that we don't have. And I'm not sure when those on the left are going to wake up to the fact that we have got to cut people living off the government. We just cannot sustain it.
All right, Christine.
Well, I think it's interesting that our conservative friends always talk about the need for a balanced budget when the only, in recent times, the only balanced budget was under the Democrats with the Clinton administration, where actually he left office with a surplus. You know, we go into the Bush administration and we came out of a Bush and we came out of a Reagan with huge deficits. So, you know, when we talk about running the country, it has been, in recent history, it has been the Democrats that have had balanced budgets. And when we talk about needing to cut from the poor and those who, you know, need the social safety net and just give more and more advantage to the very, very wealthy who have reaped huge, huge advantages under the Bush policies, I think that's just wrong. You know, this sequester, it cuts $68 million from just in Wisconsin alone from things that, you know, you might say that's all for people that are dependent, but we're talking about, you know, things like Head Start. We're talking about protections for the environment. We're talking about, you know, providing schools and teachers funding and providing, you know, the way for our schools to go forward with this money. So, you know, this isn't a situation where we're talking about things that are not necessary. And it isn't always, you know, it's very simple to say this is something that we have to take away from the very poor. That's because these are the people that are voiceless. So, you know, I really reject that argument. And I say we have to look at what is the history. The history is the Democrats are the ones that have balanced budgets and the Republicans. And we have Walker now proposing deficit spending. You know, so, you know, is deficit spending really the issue? It's not. The issue is priorities and having growth. And when we don't have growth, you know, in our country, and we don't right now because the job situation is so terrible. You know, the government is there to help promote jobs, and we haven't done a good job of that. So, you know, I think that we really have to look at the philosophy behind this and stop talking in ways that just try to rile people up for no good reason.
We need to move on to some other issues. The House and Senate did agree to a budget deal this week to fund the government through the rest of the fiscal year. So averting a threat of a government shutdown, the measure leaves in place the sequestration cuts. It does provide another $87 billion to fund overseas military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. So your reaction to this deal, Steve?
I guess the political drama has been put off until Labor Day. You know, it appears to come up every few months in the sense of, you know, government's going to shut down, oh no, and then, you know, suddenly it doesn't. This, I can't, you know, there's nothing in here that's particularly permanent. I mean, if you believe that, then you believe that Democrats did balance the budget in the 1990s, when in fact the reason that the budget was balanced, although it really wasn't, why the deficit was considerably smaller in the 1990s is because Republicans controlled Congress for 6 out of 8 years of Bill Clinton's term, and with divided government, Clinton was prevented from doing what he wanted to do that was bad, and Republicans in Congress were prevented from what they wanted to do that was bad. That's the reality. And this is just, you know, yet another political game being played that's now been pushed off for 6 months. And I confidently predict that right after Labor Day, we're going to have another budget crisis.
Christine.
Yeah, Steve, I think it's you know, I just love it when no matter what the Democrats do, it's if they do anything good, it's the Republicans that did it for them. If they do something bad, it's those lefties again. So, but on this issue of this budget passing, you know, Steve is right. You know, we've got until Labor Day, and they're going to look at it again. We're only up till September 30th with this deal. And, you know, I hope the sequester was such a ridiculously stupid way of running the government. I hope that they are able now to get serious about what are reasonable steps to take with regard to our budget and stop the cuts and things that really hurt people in our country. There's no reason to make people suffer like that. And I hope that we can make some reasonable cuts and come forward with a plan that really makes some sense.
We need to take a short break, and we will continue reviewing the news of the week with Christine Bremer-Moogley and Steve Prestigard. Coming up, it's our Week in Review quiz, and we will also talk about some of the big stories in the state of Wisconsin. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Wisconsin tourism officials unveiled a new TV ad this week to promote the state. It features actor Robert Hayes, who sets out for a fishing trip on a gorgeous summer day, and then everything goes horribly and comically wrong. The ad was directed by Shorewood native David Zucker. This was the first time that Zucker and Hayes have worked together since which 1980s movie? That's the Week in Review quiz question. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll give you, let's say 5 minutes to call in or email in your answer. We'll randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers, and you will be entitled to one of the books that we featured recently on the program. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Christine Bremer-Moogley, attorney with Bremer and Trollope Law Offices in Wausau, and Steve Prestigard, a journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. And I said we're going to talk about state issues, but first let's talk about a national survey which says that the country's views on same-sex marriage is shifting. We now are more favorable for same-sex marriage because of a shift among young people. And we also heard this week Hillary Clinton coming out in favor of same-sex marriage. Christine, your thoughts on this shift?
Well, I think it is amazing how quickly these things change in terms of public opinion. And this is one of those cases where the Congress is actually following the people, other than unlike our gun debate that we had earlier. I'm really happy for it. I think now we have to hold our breath and watch what happens with the United States Supreme Court decision on Proposition 8 in California and see if the Supreme Court follows and declares that it's unconstitutional to not allow gay couples to marry, that it's not providing them the equal protection of the law. I think that there's a good chance that Justice Kennedy will swing on this one and declare that unconstitutional. So, you know, it'll be interesting. I thought the Senator Rob Portman's coming forward as the first senator to announce his support for gay marriage was very interesting because he couched it in terms of the fact that his own son was gay. And I thought, you know, how interesting it is that when it becomes personal, then it's okay. Mm-hmm. If it's somebody else's son, it's not. But if it's my son, yeah, let's go for it. You know, so I thought, you know, that's kind of an odd way to make up your mind on things, that if it's personal to me, then I guess I'll go for it. So it's a little disappointing. But on the other hand, anything that helps promote change and this change is important. I think it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Steve?
I think the the thing about the issue that stands out is the line said, when asked why the white people favored same-sex marriage, almost one-third said they know someone who is gay, and a quarter said that their personal views have changed over time. That's probably for that reason. I don't know. I guess I thought that that if you favor something, you shouldn't question somebody's motives, which Christine just did. But since she feels that way, I guess I'll say that it's pretty obvious. If you study the Clintons over the past two decades, you know that they don't do anything unless they feel they get political benefit from it. So that's the reason that Hillary Clinton came out in support of same-sex marriage, because pretty obviously she's running for president in 3 years. I guess, you know, this is, I guess, perhaps a good example of how politics has become poison, where you get to the point where you question someone's motives for doing something what you want them to do.
Well, speaking of...
He said his motive right on it. He just told right out in this statement that was his motive because of his son. And so it's not that I'm questioning his motive. I'm just saying it's interesting that he was against it until his son was gay. And you know, with regard to Hillary coming out for president, boy, I hope so.
Well, speaking of running for president, there was a lot of talk earlier this week that Governor Scott Walker was saying he would not necessarily make a pledge that he would completely fill a second term as governor, leading many to speculate that he really wants to make this run for president. Then he kind of backpedaled on that and said there's no greater job than governor of the state of Wisconsin, and you know that's really what he wants. Is he going to run for president, Steve?
No. Nor is Paul Ryan, nor is Russ Feingold, unless he's got some wacky left-wing political party that wants to nominate him so he can get, you know, 1% of the vote or something. Here's the thing, and this is, believe it or not, a nonpartisan observation. Wisconsin isn't important in the sense of national politics, except when there is a close presidential campaign. No Wisconsin politician ever gets enough national profile, and probably more importantly, has enough money to make a credible run for president, Republican or Democrat. This is a state that's got all of 2% of the population, they've got 2% of the gross domestic product. And the other thing is, this is a state that is, I hate to put it this way, politically weird. This is the same state where Fighting Bob LaSalle and Joe McCarthy have both been U.S. senators. This is the same state where people voted for Tommy Thompson, who's no one's idea of a liberal, and Russ Feingold. And for all of those reasons, you are, and I realize never is a big thing to say, but you will never, ever see a president, or even, I would argue, a presidential, a nominee for president from the state of Wisconsin, ever.
All right. Well, Christine, do you agree?
Only on television, right? The West Wing?
Yeah.
But I think, Steve, I read your blog on that, and I thought it was very good, and I was thinking, boy, I hope he's right that we don't have to have Walker running for president. I mean, I can't even imagine anything worse from my perspective. But, you know, the other thing that I thought was an interesting point that is made in your blog, Steve, which I thought was very well done, was the fact that Walker doesn't even have a college education. And although I don't believe the story behind that is compelling, I think he just quit for a lot of reasons. But, you know, someone without a college education is even less educated than Sarah Palin, for goodness sakes. So I think that it would be very difficult for someone without a college education, with the difficulties and the hard work involved in being our president, I think it would be hard for him to get the support of the people under those circumstances. And I think the way he has divided our state in such a really terrible way does not bode well for a presidential candidacy for Scott Walker. And if you look at our record, now we're going to talk about this, I assume, Joy, but in terms of his jobs record and the record that he's had since he's been in office, certainly hasn't moved our state forward in a way that people are feeling really good about their lives now. So I don't think there's much chance at all that Scott Walker is going to be a presidential candidate that's viable for all of Steve's reasons and also for the ones I just stated.
Yeah, well, Christine, very briefly, because we are running short on time, what did you make of that report out this week that said, I think, 44th in terms of job creation in the nation?
Right. We go up from 42nd to 44th worst. We're the worst in our region. All of the states surrounding us are doing much better. Even Illinois is 30th. And Scott likes to make a lot of fun of Illinois, but they're 30th in job growth. Our unemployment rate ticked up. In my community, now we've got our paper companies being sold. There'll be, I'm certain, horrible job losses because of that. The governor has been more or less silent on that. A private equity firm has bought the paper mills in Rhinelander and Mosinee, which are the formation of middle class jobs in our region and very important to our region. I mean, it couldn't be worse. And so when we look at this jobs numbers, you know, we gain 12,000 jobs in the private sector and we lose 10,000 in the public sector. So we have 1,800 jobs net. I mean, it's just a ridiculous record when we look at all of the states surrounding us doing so well. So he hasn't been able to put into place policies or to give people that want to build jobs in our state confidence that they will be able to do so when they're going to other states and the other states in our region are doing well. So how is it possible that Scott Walker can run on a record like that? You know, his gubernatorial race is going to be a battle for him. So, you know, to think about running for president is ridiculous.
Yeah, why are we 44th, Steve?
Because the Walker administration has failed to undo all of the horrid policies, particularly the $2.1 billion tax increase of the Doyle administration. That is the answer. You have the fourth or fifth highest state and local taxes in the entire country in the state. You have one of the most anti-business organizations in state government in the Department of Natural Resources. What's been cut? What taxes have been cut? How many anti-business bureaucrats that get state checks, state paychecks, have been fired? You know, the best state in the Midwest in terms of job growth is Indiana. You know what Indiana does? Indiana, number one, has much lower taxes than Wisconsin. And number two, they didn't pass Act 10 to, you know, reduce the amount of pay that state employees got. They got rid of their public employee unions. And I'm not sure that you really want to make positive comparisons of Illinois to Wisconsin, given the fact that Illinois' unemployment rate is considerably higher. The counties that are on the border between Wisconsin and Illinois, their unemployment rates run from 9.8 to 14.6% south of the state line. Now, you really want those kind of policies?
Well, we've got 15.5% up in some areas in Wisconsin. And, Steve, you just really proved what I said.
In Menominee County, which is, you know, that's the Indian tribe, and they've always had the highest unemployment in the state.
Well, just watch what happens up north here with these big plants being closed. But you just proved my point when I said everything that goes wrong is the Democrats' fault and everything that goes right is the Republicans' fault, because you just blamed Walker's failures on Doyle. So, you know, it just doesn't end. But
let me get you both to very briefly talk a little bit about the proposed state budget. It's going to go before public hearings in April. They'll take place in Greendale, Green Bay, Lake Delton, and Baldwin near Eau Claire. The Joint Finance Committee has been combing through the proposals this week. Very briefly, since we're almost out of time, Steve, is this a good proposed state budget? Any problems with anything?
The tax cuts are not very significant at all. It's kind of modifying what's been done in the past. What really needs to happen is we need to look at doing much less in government because it costs us too much money.
All right, and Christine,
so I'm not a huge fan of the state budget, actually.
Christine, very briefly, your thoughts on the state budget.
I agree with Steve. I'm not a fan of this budget. I think the tax cut is political pandering. It doesn't do anything for anybody except give a little bit more to the rich. We don't increase money for the schools. We don't increase money for job skills in a meaningful way. You know, we're selling assets of the state. You know, there's so many things in this budget that are so, so draconian and difficult that it's hard to support it. So I absolutely think it's going to be a fight, and we're going to see a long, hot summer.
Well, we want to congratulate Elaine, who is the winner of our Week in Review quiz. She emailed her answer that the first time that Wisconsin native David Zucker and actor Robert Hayes got together before they made this new tourism, Wisconsin tourism commercial, was the 1980 movie Airplane. The 1980s movie Airplane. In this commercial, Hayes gets hit with a bucket in the head. He accidentally gets hooked with his fishing rod. He gets nailed in the face by a piece of wood. He goes on a rough tubing ride on the lake. And afterwards, he is comforted by four former Wisconsin beauty pageant winners. So, Christine,
they all live in Saner, right where it happened. The way they did it.
Yeah, Elaine emailed that she thought the ad was stupid. All right, so thank you to Elaine. We're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. Thanks very much to both of you, Christine and Steve, for being with us.
Thanks, Joy. Thanks, Steve.
Steve Prestigard, yeah, go Badgers. Steve Prestigard and Christine Bremer-Moogley. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.